You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll check out Wisconsin's up north cabin tradition and ask for your memories. First, if you've ever watched the show Shark Tank, you'll know that there are good, bad, and absurd ideas for new products. Well, a Wisconsin high school has launched a program that has students not only thinking about what makes a good product, but also creating and pitching those products to local professionals. Dan Putman is a teacher of the incubator business class at Nina High School, and Luke Meyer and Jordan Settersum are two of his students. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Luke and Jordan, thanks for joining the show.
Thanks for having us as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, Dan, let's start with the basics. Tell us a little bit about the incubator program and why and how you brought this to the school there.
The incubator program is a year-long class where the students use the lean methodology for business to create their own business, and then at the end of the year, pitch their idea in front of Shark Tank-like investors.
And how does this work, Dan, as far as a learning process for the students as opposed to the traditional study, homework, take the test?
The great thing about this class and why I really enjoy teaching it is, as a teacher, I'm actually more of the facilitator. We bring in experts on each subject matter. So if there's a unit on marketing, we actually talk to the community and find marketing experts to come in and teach the kids about marketing. And then the kids are learning about marketing while they're trying to create this business that they're working on. And at the end of the year, they actually have a product or some type of service that they've worked the whole year on creating.
And then, Luke, you and Jordan are on a project together. Do I have that right?
Right, yep.
Okay, well, the two of you, I don't know how you split up the job, but can you hit us with a little sales pitch for the product you're working on?
Sure. So our product is Cord Clip, specifically Cord Clip Mobile, and it provides premium smartphone charger protection at an affordable price.
And Jordan, how did you find a need for this product?
So we kind of discussed like problems that we'd all faced, and we noticed like a lot of people, including ourselves, just had chargers that were breaking on us, and we thought, well, we got to make something to fix this because we don't want to be spending money on new chargers. So if we can fix something that solves the problem, we'd be in good business. So that's kind of how we came up with the idea.
And Luke, was this one of a bunch of ideas? Did you like kind of go through different possibilities?
Sure. Yeah. We actually started off with a list of about 20 to 30 ideas, but narrowed it down as this became more prevalent as we asked around.
And Dan, talk about that process. It sounds like part of the goal here isn't just to brainstorm an idea yourself. It's to go out and assess where there are needs, right?
Correct. One of the first assignments we have is we create what's called a bug me list, and you, in your daily life and people around you, you look for things that causes problems or things that bother people or quote-unquote bug me. And then as you look at those problems, you list them off. And then the students will go out and they'll kind of take some of those things and they'll start doing surveys and asking people, you know, is there enough people or customers for this problem? And then after they kind of figure out, hey, yeah, this is it, like Jordan and Luke were saying, they found that this was probably the most prevalent one for them. And they said, well, let's stick with this idea because this has probably the biggest customer base for us.
And Dan, tell us a little bit about the process here. Did you come up with this incubator idea yourself? Are you borrowing ideas or a curriculum from somewhere else?
No, I did not come up with this. There is a school district in Illinois, in Barrington, Illinois, that came up with this. It's called Incubator EDU. They came up with a curriculum for it, and we found out about it, and we sent a few teachers down there, me being one of them, and we got to see the class firsthand. We just absolutely loved the idea, and we thought it was amazing. And so our school district and our superintendent said, hey, if you guys are so passionate about it, let's give it a go. And so we were able to start last fall.
Jordan, have you ever thought of yourself as an inventor or an entrepreneur before doing this class?
A little bit. I mean, I've always enjoyed like design and engineering, so that's kind of been a big part, but like none of the business side, so it's been interesting just kind of learning that side too, but I wouldn't have seen myself as like an inventor and entrepreneur.
And how about you, Luke?
Sure. So I've been pretty much... Like another thing I do is woodworking or glass engraving. So I've always been sort of an entrepreneur. So I've always seen myself as doing this.
And part of the fun here, and I guess the challenge, is you're not inventing a hypothetical project and you talk about the idea. You have to actually make a thing. What's the process like for that, Jordan, actually making this product you're trying to sell?
Yeah, so we've kind of just started with a couple designs and just kind of going over, like, what's actually going to work. And then once we kind of get that, we're reaching out to, like, manufacturers and people who kind of know what they're doing more than us high schoolers do, and just kind of seeing how we would proceed with going and making it actually. So it's an interesting process going from, like, on paper then actually to a manufacturer.
And, Dan, what kind of facilities do you have at the school? I understand there's a 3D printer the students have access to.
Yeah, we have a lot of great things here. We have many 3D printers. We have laser engravers. I know Luke and Jordan are starting to play with an injection mold machine. We have a lot of things, and the great thing about our school is we're a lot of the teachers in our area that have better expertise than I am are more than willing to help out and give kids the opportunity to use them.
We're talking about a high school business incubator class in Neenah. We have Dan Putnam with us. He's the teacher of that class. And Luke Meyer and Jordan Setterstrom are students participating in incubator. Now, I understand three local people in the business and entrepreneur community came for an event kind of like the Shark Tank TV show. And you had to kind of pitch your idea to them. Luke, what was this like to be in front of some professionals and making the case here?
Sure. So it was definitely a little bit nerve-wracking at the beginning, but after we started going and seeing our investors' faces sort of light up and, like, really understand our idea, it got a lot more smooth, and we gained confidence as we finished.
And Jordan, do you think that having been through this maybe could lead you to be able to do this again in the future, even out of school?
Yeah, I think it's, like, equipped me with some good skills, just how to, like, come up with an idea for a business and, like, how to put that in fruition. So, yeah, definitely.
Is this a fun class, too? I mean, you're getting something out of it. Let's start with you, Jordan. Is this fun?
Yeah, I mean, it's different from your normal class. You're not walking in just sitting in a desk and listening to a lecture. You're actually working on something that you have a passion for, and just makes the class super interesting.
And how about you, Luke?
Definitely fun for me. I love design work, and that's what I've been doing for the last few months, so love it.
And Dan, I mentioned the TV show Shark Tank. One of the students who's been in this before, I guess, was actually on the actual TV show Shark Tank. Can you tell us about that?
Correct. Yeah, there was a student who started his business at a Chicago area school. And then for the last couple of years, he's been working on it, and then just went recently, I think a month ago, on the Shark Tank and actually got money from three sharks on the TV show. So it's kind of one of those great things for us to show the kids that, like, this isn't just a class. Like, it's as far as you want to take it, and you can even go on TV and get $150,000 or whatnot from sharks there.
Do you, Dan, and maybe even students, too, meet with people doing incubator classes outside of Neenah, elsewhere around the country?
Currently, right now, we're mainly just in the Fox cities, just because of our, just logistically.
Sure.
We have a lot of people from, like, the Green Bay area and those types of things, but I know some of our groups, because of just where things are located, they've been calling other areas. Some groups, when they're in their very beginning stages of looking at a business idea, were thinking maybe in a bigger city their problem would be more of a problem. So they were calling Chicago, calling New York, and seeing if this idea would be something that people there would like. So they were calling different places. But for the logistics of testing ideas, a lot of times we have to stay in this area.
There's still some school year to go. Jordan, what is next for your project?
We're just finishing up, like, the logistics of our design, and then eventually just kind of going into manufacturing, and then just starting to get feedback on our product and hopefully start selling.
And Luke, if I were in this position, A, I probably would have made a very bad product, but B, I might be getting antsy and wanted to do something new. Do you have? Are you coming up with new ideas as you do this, in addition to the project you're working on?
So, as far as cord clip goes, we're actually looking for, in the future, branching from not only smartphone cables but to computer cables, maybe eventually medical. But there's definitely growth to be had, and there's different avenues to be taken later in the process.
And Dan, as we wrap up, it sounds like this year's incubator class has been a success. Are you going to be doing this more in the future?
Yes, we. I think for us, we as a school district, we see this as what we want education to look like. It's not necessarily a business thing, but it's the idea that kids are able to follow a passion and to do things in the real world and to be out and talking with businesses and to experience those things in this area and at this time in their life is probably just the most beneficial thing for them.
All right. Well, Luke and Jordan, good luck. Dan, good luck with the class. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Neenah High School teacher Dan Putman and two students, Luke Meyer and Jordan Setterstrom. They join us to talk about the Incubator Business Class that has students creating their own businesses and connecting with community professionals. Coming up, we want to hear your memories from up north or out in nature at a cabin or camping. Did you grow up going to a family cabin or go up to the same campsite with your family year after year? Do you do those things now with your family? I'd like to hear your stories and your memories now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Wisconsin Life visits a cabin now. Here's executive producer Steve Gotcher.
At the risk of repeating a cliche, what's in a name? When it comes to summer dwellings in northern Wisconsin, as Sharon Cummins explains, doesn't really matter.
When I moved here 6 years ago from Nebraska, I was prepared for the Packers. The cheese.
Oh, that's great cheese, dear.
Oh, cheese.
Oh, those are great cheese curds.
And the snow. I wasn't prepared for the jargon. What were cabins, cottages, lake houses, and places up north? Was there some secret dictionary of Wisconsin real estate that I hadn't been issued upon crossing the Mississippi? And just exactly what constituted up north? Was there some map I hadn't seen? My interest in these terms first surfaced when my husband and I bought a house in Madison. We began to get to know our neighbors, and slowly, we learned about each other's lives outside of our little cul-de-sac. As summer approached, we'd hear of the efforts to remove sand burrs and of a squirrel that sadly met its end in an upstairs bedroom. I began to learn that most of the people on the block had, or had once, owned a cottage, a cabin, or a place up north. What I couldn't figure out was what exactly this meant. Had I somehow managed to move into a neighborhood where everyone was a secret multimillionaire? Just what were these second homes? Were they lavish like on House Hunters? My mom watched that show, and she assured me they were probably amazing places. I should get an invite, and she'd like to come along. But there were also tales about freezing pipes and winterization, and maybe making the cottage all season. All season? As in a screened-in porch? In Nebraska, people really don't have second houses. You either live in town or you live on the farm. Well, okay, maybe I'm simplifying. If you live in ranch country, you might, just might, have a ranch house and a townhouse, but only so the kids can go to school in town during the week. And you sell it as soon as the kids graduate, because why on earth would you have two houses? I kept thinking about cottages and cabins. A cabin must have muskies and walleyes on the chinked log walls. Maybe it has running water, but probably not. A cottage, though, it must be whitewashed and have baskets of river rocks stacked by the fireplace. This surely is the type of place where Mother Goose lives. Now, a place up north? Well, maybe that's like my colleague's hunting land, which his wife finally let him buy, where you have a trailer and probably a portable propane tank. When one neighbor put their cabin up for sale, I wanted to find it online so I could see just what this cabin looked like. But alas, I could never quite remember where it was at. Minocqua, Menasha, north of Oconomowoc what? In Nebraska, the town names sound an awful lot like dead presidents. Years went by until my luck changed. Our friends Todd and Maggie invited us up to the cottage for the weekend. The baby was weaning himself and was crabby. We were sleepy, and Maggie warned that there may be storms. But no, we were going. I was going to get to see, in person, a real Wisconsin cottage. Maybe I'd finally start to unravel this mystery. We boated, drank old fashions, were tutored in euchre, and had the best time. I walked around the lake, and slowly, I realized it didn't really matter what they were called. They were lovely, in all their variety. Small, large, all season, or summer only. I hope I get invited back, maybe next time, to a cabin.
Sharon Cummins is a marketing professor at UW-Whitewater. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now we want to keep the cabin conversation going and invite you to join in. Do you have a cabin or cottage or campsite memory in your family, or is there something you do now? Do you own a second place, maybe up north? Do you rent a regular place again and again, or do you go camping in the same spot with your family? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And what do you do when you go to the cabin or cottage? Lounge around, or is there a lot of work to be done to maintain it? Is there euchre involved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Dan in Milwaukee starts us off. Dan, hi.
Good afternoon.
I'll take either. What's your story, Dan?
I had a friend about 40 years ago that had purchased a cabin at 47 acres up near Lac des Flambeaux, totally surrounded by the Shawangunk National Forest. It had the only private property on the lake, and it had a quarter mile of frontage on the stream. And our 40-acre parcel had 7 acres on the other side of the stream. And a friend of ours had bought it on a land contract, and he was going to sell it. But a bunch of us had been up there for fishing and hunting and so on and so forth. So we said, Ron, you know, if you sell this thing now and you owe this balance on the land contract, you're not going to get dime one out of it. The real estate commissions are going to eat up whatever you get, and the balance will have to go to paying off the land contract. Now, let's you put your land contract, I will form a corporation. You put your land contract in the corporation, take out 100 shares of stock, and then the four of us will give you $1,000 apiece for 20 shares of stock. So we'll have five owners that each owned 20% of the cabin. And that was a marvelous deal. I bought in for $1,000. We were organized under the business corporation law.
Wow.
Whenever anything really expensive came, we didn't do any business. And so we had to pass an assessment on the stock to pay the real estate taxes and insurance and for repairs and whatnot.
Gotcha. Now, Dan, it sounds like there's a lot of bookkeeping going on here. I hope you had some fun up there, too, right?
Oh, never. We never had any fun, except for the fact that it was called the HVAD Corp, or Half Vast Acres Development Company.
Dan, thanks a lot for sharing the story. Well, a lot went into pulling that one together. I'm going to assume that they did fun stuff up there, too, sometimes. Dan, thanks a lot for getting us started. We'll go now to Deanne with her cottage story in Menominee. Deanne, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
I loved the story that the woman had on from Whitewater before this. I grew up, my grandparents had a cottage up north in Bruce and on Lake Pulaski, and it was my absolute favorite place in the world to go, still is, and I feel very fortunate because my kids are going to have the opportunity to continue to go there because my parents have purchased it now in their retirement, and so now it's their cottage and their home. And I think one of the best things about it is that my grandpa Earl, everybody knew him, and he had the first pontoon back in 1977, a big, bright yellow banana pontoon, and it's still on the lake today. I think
Fantastic.
We're on, like, our seventh motor, but we still have that pontoon, and everybody knows it. You say, oh, we're the cabin with the yellow pontoon, and everybody knows it. So,
Deanne, how often do you get up there?
during the summer, we try to get up every weekend, but now my children are old enough to have sports activities on the weekends. Oh, yeah. So as long as we're not at a tournament or a ball field, we're up at the cabin.
Deanne, thanks so much for sharing that story. Yeah, one of my first friends when I moved to Wisconsin, his family had a cabin on Lake Pulaski between Ladysmith and Bruce. So I have spent time at a great lake. I loved my time up there. Thank you, Deanne, for sharing that story. We're asking for your cabin and cottage memories right now. We'll go next to Pat in Tomahawk. Pat, hi.
Hi, I'm driving on Highway 51 almost to Tomahawk, so I'm in the Great North right now. I grew up in Waukesha, and my dad was born in the UP, and he bought land by the south branch of the Oconto River in Oconto County, bought the popple logs, and I can remember probably that was 57, it was four, but I remember the skinning of the logs, the building of the log cabin,
wow,
the chinking, and of course every summer going up, my mom, my dad, and my two brothers and I, and we had our projects, but once they were done, or lunchtime, then we could go fishing, or of course after supper was always, let's go for a ride and see if we can see some deer, berry picking.
Pat, thank you so much for sharing that story. We heard from some of our colleagues, Karina, in our Milwaukee office. I think so. She has memories growing up as a city kid, going up to her step uncle's cabin, and she says there's nothing like eating a roasted marshmallow while gazing at the Milky Way. That actually being able to see the stars is one of the greatest reasons to get out in the middle of nowhere. And Susanna had a story getting out to a cabin, and at the end of it, she remembers somebody saying, "Look at Susanna, she's relaxed." So that's one of the great stories about being in a cabin or cottage or camping, getting that relaxation in at long last. Keep sharing your stories. Tell us about your cabin or cottage. Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Now we just finished celebrating the best movies of 2017. The 90th Academy Awards took place on Sunday with The Shape of Water winning Best Picture. And while some other movies like Dunkirk and Lady Bird received some critical accolades last year, the rest of the movie industry is a different story. You might even be frustrated by the options at your local movie theater, all the superhero movies and endless sequels, with maybe the occasional Phantom Thread type art film tucked in there for good measure. But why are things like this? It turns out there's a method to studio executives' madness, one aimed at making the most money possible, thanks to franchises, cinematic universes, and lots of merchandising. But is that strategy actually working, and is it making it more difficult for unique, standalone movies to make it to the big screen? Ben Fritz is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal covering the entertainment industry. His new book is The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. He joins to try and answer some of those questions. Ben, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Ben, you say we're in the midst of a huge transformation in movies. What is going on?
Yeah, in my book, I call it the franchise era of films. Studios used to really succeed by making a broad array of films. I'm sure you and your listeners recall, you used to be able to go to the multiplex. There'd be romantic comedies. There'd be dramas for adults. There'd be original movies. And then there'd be a few other superhero films. Now when you go, it feels like it's almost all superhero movies, Fast and Furious, franchise-driven movies, you know, the latest Star Wars, et cetera. They're all coming from brands. And it's really, there's been a huge transformation in the film business where it's really driven by brands and franchises that are meant to appeal to a large global audience. And a lot of other films have fallen by the wayside, especially original dramas for adults. It's worth noting, one of my favorite things, you recall in 1988 or 89, if you recall the movie Rain Man, mm-hmm. It was the number one movie in America. Most popular film. Rain Man probably wouldn't even get made by a Hollywood studio.
I guess this is happening because it works. These movies make lots and lots of money, right?
They do. They absolutely make a lot of money. Our tastes have changed, and there's a few reasons why these make the most money. One is the movie business has gone global. It's not just what Americans care about. It's what people in China and Russia and Brazil and Italy and Mexico think. And if you want a movie that's going to appeal to everyone, whether you're in Wisconsin or you're in Shanghai, or you're in Israel or you're in France, it can't be too specific, right? It can't be really culturally specific. It needs to be broadly understandable. Well, a big special effects movie is easy to understand. It doesn't matter what language you speak. It doesn't matter if you understand American culture. At the same time, I bet not many of your listeners buy DVDs anymore, and it was DVD sales that used to make a lot of these diverse kinds of movies possible. And that's a huge revenue source for Hollywood that's fallen away. And, of course, these companies are all part of huge corporations now. Disney is a huge corporation. Universal is owned by Comcast. Disney is buying Fox right now, as you may know. AT&T is buying Time Warner. And these big companies, they don't just want a successful movie. They want a brand that can also become a theme park ride and a T-shirt and a toy. And, there are obviously no Rain Man toys, right? But there's lots of there are lots of toys and theme park rides and everything for all the Marvel superhero films and Transformers and films like that.
Well, I look at the last year and I look at Get Out as a movie that didn't cost much to make and made a lot of money. But then reading your book, I'm thinking there's not going to be a Get Out theme park ride. I'm guessing we don't have a lot of Get Out lunchboxes and action figures out there. Even though it was successful in movie terms, from the perspective of people wanting to make serious money, even that might not be a lesson, right?
That's right. Look, Get Out was very successful, made a lot of money, but there's not going to be a sequel. There's no spin-offs. There's no toys, like you said. So it doesn't make the kind of money that, like, a Jumanji does or a Spider-Man or a Despicable Me, where those keep making hundreds of millions of dollars far into the future. Get Out came out, made its money, and was done. And for every Get Out, there's so many lower-budget films that come out and they don't succeed the box office anymore. The reason Get Out is it's so rare in the current environment. It used to be common. And one other factor I forgot to mention, but I'm sure you're familiar with this huge, is think about how much better TV has gotten, how many great shows there are on cable, on HBO, on Netflix, and Amazon. It used to be TV was the idiot box, right? If you stay home and watch TV, it was low quality. Now TV is really great. So why go to the theater to see an original drama when there's so many great ones to see at home?
Talking to Ben Fritz, his new book is The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. Ben, you tell in the book the story of kind of how this developed, and you do it through the lens mostly of Sony Pictures, and you did interviews of your own, of course, but you had this treasure trove, this hack of Sony Pictures that let so much of the internal dialogue come out from behind the scenes. What did you learn from that?
Yeah, I wanted to tell the story of how Hollywood's changed, and I didn't just want to pontificate. I wanted to take my readers inside a studio so they could see firsthand. And the hack of Sony Pictures, really gave me that entry. You know, I spent a year reading every single email and document from that hack, and most of them were boring, but a few of them were treasure troves. And I took that small percentage that were interesting, put them all together, and created a narrative of a studio trying to adapt to this transformation of the movie business. And I really discovered that. The movie executives weren't happy about this. They love to make the different kinds of movies. The reason they came into Hollywood was to make original, interesting movies, but they could just see that audience tastes were changing tremendously, and the executives at Sony were struggling to keep up. This was a studio that was very successful in the 2000s. They were the home of Will Smith and Adam Sandler back when movie stars were a really big deal. They made a broad array of interesting movies for adults. But as audience taste, move toward like the Marvel superhero movies and Fast and Furious and so on, Sony didn't have those big franchises, and they struggled to keep up, and their profits started falling significantly. And so the book is in part a picture of a studio struggling to adapt to the changes that we all see at the theaters.
And you followed an email thread of a pivotal moment where these studio executives, right, these towering figures in their industry, had to make this presentation to Wall Street outside investors. They had to sell themselves in a way that they didn't have to before.
And they did. This is a really fantastic scene a couple of years ago when Sony was struggling, and Sony has shareholders, of course, and so they had to try to present their business and make it seem like they had a plan to deal with all these changes. And so they went to one of their sound stages in the Sony Pictures lot here in Los Angeles. And, usually you imagine a sound stage is where all the glamorous stuff happens. It's, the actors and the cameras and the movie stars and the makeup. And now instead it's these studio executives who came here to make movies trying to sell themselves to Wall Street, trying to convince these big shareholders and Wall Street analysts that they can make movies that will, appeal to the global audience that likes Marvel and likes Pixar and likes Transformers and so on. And you can tell from the emails and some subsequent interviews I did that these Sony Pictures executives found it pretty humiliating. This is not what they came to Hollywood to do, yet this is what studio executives these days have to do. Their first audience is not us. Their first audience is Wall Street.
We're talking to Ben Fritz. His new book is The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. We're looking at how movies get made today and how that might be changing in the years to come. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the state of the movies in 2018? Are you feeling burned out on sequels and franchises and cinematic universes? Or are you happy to pick up the next Marvel movie or Star Wars installment? What kind of movies are you not seeing on the big screen that you want to? And do you see movies on the big screen, or do you hold out and see them at home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. We pick up the conversation with Ben Fritz, author of the new book, The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Are you glad to see? Do you like seeing the Marvel Cinematic Universe get more and more installments, or the Star Wars franchise get developed more? Or are you thinking, there's not enough different kinds of movies out there for me, and how do you watch your movies? At home, at the theater, not at all? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go straight to your calls. Kevin is with us in Janesville. Kevin, hi.
Hi. Got a couple of comments. I don't mind the franchise reinstallments. Kind of fun to watch those, but I do get kind of tired of sequel after sequel after remake after remake. And frankly, Mel Brooks called this years ago during the movie Spaceballs, when he took everybody to the gift shop and said, merchandising is where the real money from the movie is made.
Kevin, thank you so much for bringing that up. Yeah, Star Wars in some ways started this merchandising thing, but it's gone into hyperdrive lately, Ben. Can you talk about how this developed from Mel Brooks' merchandising?
Yeah, it was my favorite movie when I was a kid. Look, Star Wars really did kick this off. It was one of the first sort of big summer event films, of course, way back in 77, and, you know, one of the first franchises. You know, there was that original trilogy and then another trilogy in the late 90s and early 2000s, and it really showed how much money can be made from the merchandise, more money can be made from the merchandise than from the movies themselves, and movies, in fact, may not be a business made to make money from the movies. That movies can be a business made to make money from the merchandise, and the films are really big advertisements. But of course, think about how Star Wars has changed. It was bought by Disney for $4 billion. And remember, the Star Wars movies came out every 3 years during the original trilogy, and then there was a long break. Now there's a new Star Wars movie every year. The last one came out in December, The Last Jedi. The next one comes out in May, the new Han Solo film. So Disney, which is really the most successful studio with this new way of making films, the franchise era, they have absolutely taken Star Wars to light speed, so to speak.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Aaron in Oshkosh. Aaron, hi.
Yes, thank you for taking my call, everybody. I appreciate that. I will try to be as quick and succinct as possible.
Go for it.
Just like the music industry has had to learn to adjust to the new paradigm, we have to kind of give the movie industry a grain of salt. You know, they're trying to keep the lights on. Now that we have the advent of 4K streaming, Dolby VHX, to the comfort of our 75-inch TVs at home, myself personally and most of the people I know, it's got to be something very, you know, stunning with a big pull that's going to tell me I have to see this in a super, super wide screen to get me out of the house. Although I'm a big fan of intelligent and humanistic inclined stories, those movies realistically tend not to bring home the bucks.
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. I think a lot of us have been there, Ben. I could see this movie at home and it'll be just as good. Oh, that movie, Star Wars or something like that. Yeah, that I've got to get out to see on the big screen. And that's got to be a pain for the movie producers.
It is. Something a lot of executives in Hollywood talk about now, and is very evident in the book, is that the bar has been raised. What they mean by that is the minimum level of excitement that you need to get audiences out of their homes and into the theater, like your caller, has been raised significantly. Again, back when TV wasn't very good,
and maybe all we have is a VHS tape, or you had to wait a long time for the DVD even, you went to the movie theater to see something good and interesting. Now, just turn on Netflix, and it costs you zero more dollars to watch so much more good stuff, including movies. Netflix and Amazon are making original movies now, not just TV shows. So if you're going to go to the theater, it better be something that's this visual effects extravaganza that, you know, you can't, it doesn't look as good in your home theater, or that rare film that everybody's talking about and you have to go see to be part of the cultural moment. You know, everybody was talking about Wonder Woman last summer, and if you didn't, or Black Panther right now. And if you're not seeing it, you feel like you're missing out.
Let's bring on another caller. Kelly is with us in Eau Claire. Kelly, hi.
Hi. So just to let you know where I'm coming from, the last three movies I've seen in the theater were Wonder, The Greatest Showman, and Hostiles. Very different, very unique. They were the family films. Hostiles, my wife had a hard time sitting through it, but she thought it was great at the end. My comment and question is, what's with the multiple production companies? It seems instead of having one production company, there's six or more.
Yeah, Kelly, thanks. We have limited time, but Ben, yeah, you see three or five or six or whatever different production tags at the beginning of each movie, it seems like.
Sure. I think what you're, especially for a film like Hostiles, when you'll see all those, because an actual regular studio, so to speak, like Fox or Universal, didn't make that. The money came from all sorts of different places. If you're making those kind of non-franchise films, you have to raise your money from unusual sources, because the studios don't make those kind of films much anymore. So when you're raising money from five or six different sources, that means you got to put five or six different companies' logos at the front of your movie.
Kelly, thanks for the call. Ben, I know you said you didn't just want to pontificate in your book, but I get the impression that you don't like it that we're not going to movie theaters as much. There's something different about the communal experience of seeing a movie as opposed to sitting in the living room and watching it.
I do think there's something lost. Look, I love Netflix as much as anyone, and I think that's a perfectly fine part of our content diet. But the great thing about a movie theater is when you see something together with a group of people and you have that communal experience. You know, I remember where I was when I saw Return of the Jedi, you know, and I was a little kid. We all remember where we are when we see great movies. I don't think we necessarily remember sitting on the couch watching this TV show, especially if it's on our DVR or Netflix queue. We don't remember where we were when we happened to get around to streaming it. Those are special moments, and it's a special moment for our culture when we're all seeing the same film around the same time. Everybody's talking about Black Panther now. Black Panther was something to stream on your TV. Maybe I'll get around to it in a month or two. You know, watch it when I watch it. But we're all, if I want to see Black Panther now, we're all talking about having seen Black Panther. That's an awesome and important thing. That's why movies make such a big impact on our culture. And if that goes away entirely, I think it'll be a shame.
Are we ever going to see another impact movie with that kind of scope that isn't part of a franchise, as Black Panther is?
We'll see some. I mean, it's only been a year since Get Out. We will see, but there are fewer and fewer of them. They're just going to become rarities. Is the answer. And there may only be one or two per year. Whereas I think, you know, it wasn't that long ago when there was a new one every month.
Are you hoping that? I mean, this was a big change. Are you hoping that there's going to be a second change that shakes things up and makes it a little different anytime soon?
I am hopeful, and Hollywood can be cyclical, and things will change again. But I think fundamentally, I don't think we're gonna suddenly be streaming less content. I don't think that the digital revolution is reversible. I think the good news is all these companies, tech companies, getting into content like Apple and Amazon and Netflix, obviously is so huge now, and AT&T buying Time Warner. The reason they produce content is they want you to be engaged in their universe. They want you to use Apple products or use Amazon Prime, and they produce a lot of content to get you in their universes. So we are losing our movie theater experience a bit, but we're getting more and more great content. It's really a golden age for great visual content, whether it's a movie or a TV show, and whether you watch it on the big screen or on your TV screen or on your iPad or perhaps on your new virtual reality headset next year. So in that sense, it's good.
Ben, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
I really appreciate you having me on.
That's Ben Fritz. He's a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where he covers the entertainment industry. We've been talking about his new book. It's called The Big Picture, The Fight for the Future of Movies. A public hearing is set for tonight in Sturtevant on a plan to take 7 million gallons of water a day from Lake Michigan. The water would be used at the huge Foxconn factory planned for Racine County. The The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is holding tonight's hearing as part of its review of the proposal. Chuck Kornbach reports the water diversion plan is controversial.
The Foxconn plant will make liquid crystal display panels for computer screens, medical equipment, and other devices. The site could eventually employ up to 13,000 people. Governor Scott Walker continues to be the chief cheerleader for Foxconn. He put the job number in context at a manufacturing conference last week in Milwaukee.
13,000 people is bigger than 96% of all the municipalities in the state of Wisconsin. That's like dropping a whole city in the state of Wisconsin.
But a factory the size of a city, it needs a lot of water in the production process. Foxconn proposes the water come from here. At the Racine Water Utility, a filtering system called a submerged membrane treats water piped in from Lake Michigan. General Manager Keith Haas says his plant is up to date and can handle growth.
After the cryptosporidium outbreak in Milwaukee in 1995, we took the water that we've been treating for decades and now purify it even finer to take out bacteria.
The utility not only supplies Racine, but also some surrounding communities, including the village of Mount Pleasant, where Foxconn would be based. But because part of the Foxconn plant would be in a portion of Mount Pleasant that's outside the Great Lakes Basin, rules of the 2008 Great Lakes Compact kick in. Under that agreement, the home state, in this case Wisconsin, has to approve transfers of lake water to communities that straddle the edge of the watershed. Environmentalists question the plan on several fronts. Attorney Jody Habish-Sinikin is with Midwest Environmental Advocates. She says the proposed diversion would primarily benefit a company. She argues the multi-state agreement narrowly limits diversions to public, largely residential purposes.
It's another wrinkle in this particular end run. And that's what we're seeing, this as an end run around the compact.
Governor Walker says the private sector in Racine has long used Lake Michigan water. He says a lot more used to be consumed.
In fact, there's been a 47% reduction for the water utility sales to industrial customers, largely because in Racine, sadly, in the last 20 years, we've seen a major reduction in manufacturing and industrial jobs.
Walker says Foxconn will bring some of the jobs back without harming lake water levels. But environmentalists say about one-third of the 7 million gallons of water Foxconn would take in every day would never make it back to Lake Michigan. It would evaporate or disappear in production through what's called consumptive use. Ezra Meyer of Clean Wisconsin is also concerned about lake water quality. Foxconn plans to pipe its industrial sewage to the Racine wastewater treatment plant. Meyer wonders if Racine could properly treat the chemicals before discharging to the lake, or would Foxconn?
Is Foxconn going to do things up at the plant to take care of the chemical constituents that would be in there that would be of concern in the lake? You know, we've looked around the world at Foxconn's other manufacturing facilities that are similar to the one that they're proposing here, and there's a lot of nasty chemicals in there.
Jenny Trick is with the Racine County Economic Development Corporation. She says she hopes Foxconn gets the clean water it needs. She says she's confident the local drinking water and wastewater treatment plants would protect Lake Michigan.
There's always the concern that people are good stewards, but I'm thankful that we have some very good partners that have some very high success rates to make sure that this natural resource is protected.
This spring, the DNR is expected to make its recommendation on the Great Lakes water diversion request involving Foxconn. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, President Trump says his White House is not in chaos despite a high level of staff turnover. We'll talk to an expert on government and management about the impact of record high departures in high level White House jobs. A reporter tells us why doctors who are punished for misbehavior in one state can get jobs in other states and why it's hard to track their past behavior when they do. And we'll meet a Wisconsin curler on the way to the Paralympic Games in South Korea. That and a look at the top news of the day. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.